A politician resigns in disgrace. Another's future is in doubt.
The allegations against me today, made public by the ABC, are false.
What does the treatment of Me Too allegations in Parliament say about working women's ability to report?
And I feel incredibly disappointed that she had the control of this issue in the way she wanted to deal with it, taken away from her.
In the last two sitting weeks of the year, as the March election looms, the handling of sexual assault allegations has thrown New South Wales Parliament into a tailspin. It sparked the resignation of Labor opposition leader Luke Foley.
I can't fight to clear my name and fight an election at the same time.
A defamation threat, an apology from Corrections Minister David Elliott, and a statement from alleged victim ABC journalist Ashley Raper that she never wanted to give.
She is a good person. She was dragged into this in more than one way. I believe Ashley.
On Monday, former ABC Managing Director Michelle Guthrie alleged former Chairman Justin Milne touched her inappropriately, which he denies.
Inappropriate touching is the best description of it. I felt icky.
Then on Tuesday, an allegation of sexual violence was levelled by one Greens MP against one of her own colleagues. What do these events expose about the lives of working women? Is it ever okay to out someone else's Me Too allegations? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Jacqueline Maley, filling in for Tory Maguire. This week, the conduct of New South Wales parliamentarians has been called into question.
I think Luke needs to take the next few days to consider his political future.
When Labor leader Luke Foley allegedly groped ABC journalist Ashley Raper at a Christmas party in 2016, she decided not to report it. But in what has been described as political point scoring, Corrections Minister David Elliott raised the matter without her consent in Parliament. Then on Tuesday, a New South Wales Greens MP, Jenny Leong, broke ranks and used parliamentary privilege to call for Greens MP Jeremy Buckingham to resign. Buckingham has been accused of sexually assaulting Greens staffer Ella Buckland in 2011, but an independent investigation has already found the claim to be unsubstantiated. To discuss this with me is writer, activist and LGBTIQ campaigner Sally Rugg, The Age's social affairs editor Mickey Perkins, and Women's Agenda contributing editor Georgina Dent. Ladies, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Pleasure.
Later this episode, we will be speaking with crime reporter John Sylvester in Melbourne about the tragic terror attack on Bourke Street that claimed the life of iconic restaurateur Sisto Malaspina. But first, we're going to start with the sexual harassment allegations that seem to be swirling around everywhere at the moment and how they've been handled. First of all, Sally, I'll go to you. Do you think it's ever okay to out someone else's alleged attack without their consent?
Oh, gosh, what a minefield. Two things at play here. The two tensions are respecting the victim of the harassment or assault and sort of like respecting that person's agency and capacity to consent as to whether that story is being told. And so I would probably err on the side to say that it's not okay. The tension is, though, whether an incident is in the public interest. So I know that when we're referring to Ashley Raper and Luke Foley, you know, there is an argument bubbling around, well, is it in the public interest that someone who is our alternative premier behaves this sort of way towards women? Personally, I err on the side of saying that no, it's not okay to use women's stories of survival for political gain.
And certainly there might be different sort of things that come into play from a journalistic perspective. So Mickey, I might go to you on that. We report all the time on people who are in the public eye or thrust into public events unwillingly. We report on victims. We do it, we hope, in a sensitive way. But and, you know, just as the police will often prosecute a case with an unwilling victim because a crime's been committed, isn't there a public interest case or a journalistic case to write about survivors or victims of sexual assault and harassment without their consent?
I might have some of my colleagues disagree with me on this, but actually I think generally no, I don't think it's okay to take someone's agency away from them in that way. And one of the things we have to consider here is that it's about power and control. So when someone, you know, allegedly assaults or harasses somebody, it's about them exerting their power and control over that woman. And if we think about why women do come forward and make reports, it's also about them getting that agency back, them feeling powerful again, them, I guess, wresting it away from their alleged assailant. So from a journalistic point of view, when I'm doing stories, I actually don't do stories with women who don't want to tell their story publicly. I think that there are other ways that women can perhaps pursue justice or some sort of healing, you know, without having to go into the public sphere. I know that this was a matter where the alleged assailant was, you know, the opposition leader, but I still think that that woman's right is to own that story and make her decisions, because she's obviously had a lot of power taken away from her and feels vulnerable.
The reality is when these stories are told, it is usually the women who bear the brunt of that fallout. So it's, we don't protect women and protect their confidentiality because, you know, in principle, we do it because, or journalists might want to do it because we know that those women are likely to face re-traumatisation. They're likely to face a sort of trial by media.
And very practically, they're likely to, you know, lose their jobs, things like that. Women are making these big, careful decisions all the time around this stuff. And it's not just high-profile women or women who are journalists or politicians. It's ordinary women who are having to decide, you know, around their kind of living arrangements, their income, their workplace. And I think by removing that agency from them, we're just perpetuating the same kind of act, in that they then feel completely disempowered, completely pissed off with the system. And it, you know, it's another process of traumatising them again.
I think also in this case, when we are talking about Ashley Raper and Luke Foley, I agree with you, Mickey, and you, Sally, that the individual affected it's her agency that ought to be respected. I would have more time for people if they disrespected that agency, if I thought that they were genuinely motivated by helping victims in any way. I don't necessarily agree with that anyway, but here it's so blatant that it's been used cynically. This information was not told because someone is desperately trying to improve the situation of women in workplaces.
Right. So you're saying basically, I think you're getting to the motivation or the, you know, the sort of putative political motivation of someone like Corrections Minister David Elliott, who famously used parliamentary privilege to put this allegation to, or to really make this accusation to, the opposition leader, Luke Foley. And he was roundly criticised for doing so because it was seen as political point scoring. What do you think? How did he expect it to play out, do you think, David?
Well, if he didn't expect what's happened, I'd be very surprised. But I think the fact that it took him, a day and a half to actually come out and apologise after he did that, and I understand that was sort of at the behest of his party colleagues. He didn't do that out of the sort of goodness of his heart necessarily. I don't think my take is that he didn't genuinely consider the impact that it would have on her, or the impact that would be felt, that would resonate with women more broadly, that did happen after he told that story. And I think that in itself is quite telling, that I don't think there was any regard given to how it would play out for her.
And is it telling of what? Telling of a lag between the political class and the way that women are thinking about these issues, and men as well. I mean, I had an extraordinary amount of men talk to me about how outraged they were by David Elliott's decision to put this on the record in that way, and to put Ashley Raper in the centre of it.
I might be being dramatic here, but when I say it's telling, I think it's just a classic disrespect of the woman.
Yeah.
I don't think he was thinking of Ashley Raper as an individual. I don't think he was thinking of her career, of her life, of her as a human being. I think he was thinking, what's the big outcome here? What can we achieve? And I think that is telling, that you can be so blind to the impact of your actions on another person. And I think it is representative of the power imbalance that we see, because, you know, he's in a position of power. He can use his parliamentary privilege to do that. And he thought, in my view, he thought nothing of exposing her in this way.
What about the substantive sort of allegations, whether or not they make a person, a man, unfit to be leader? He didn't go so far himself when he gave that press conference. He said basically, once the allegations are put to me or out there in the public sphere, and I need to fight them, and therefore I can't do that and be leader at the same time. Is someone who has made what he might characterise as a drunken mistake, does that make him unfit for leadership? Sally, I might go to you on that.
I think characterising the assault that was perpetrated against Ashley Raper by Luke Foley, allegedly, I think characterising that as a drunken mistake in and of itself would suggest that someone is not fit for leadership. I think that is completely out of step with of a view that the majority of people would hold, that what allegedly went down is assault. I mean, this Me Too movement, if we can call it that, I think is very interesting because it's two parts, right? It's incidents of assault or harassment is one thing, and then it's how these men sort of deal with that. So whether they apologise, whether they withdraw from public life, what steps they take towards reparations. So Do I think that Luke Foley can, you know, is of leadership material in the fallout, like from this incident and from the fallout? Personally, no.
I think, Jackie, when you pose that question, there's actually two different questions that I look at. You know, should someone be fit for leadership? And will they be viewed as fit for leadership? And I think that, you know, in an ideal world, you might have thought that some people would think about, you know, Donald Trump, the US president, for example, the comments that he made about grabbing women by the pussies. To some people, me included, you might think that's an individual that shows such disregard for other human beings that that disqualifies him, in my view, from being of sound leadership skills, attributes, values. But the reality is he was still elected. And so I think there is a real issue there in terms of what we are willing to accept and tolerate from leaders, because we have seen, and I mean the Me Too movement has exposed the fact that sexual harassment is incredibly prolific. It's happening from people in power. And there certainly have been instances where people are losing positions of power because of this. But you wouldn't say that overall sort of serial harassers are being eradicated from leadership positions. And I think the unfortunate reality is that for some people, they would not see this action of Luke Foley's as impacting on his capacity for leadership.
Doesn't that also sort of speak to the normality of it? I mean, he allegedly said to Ashley Raper in her version of events or her account that I'm not a groper, I'm just a drunken idiot. And it seems to me that probably a lot of men think along those lines, and because this behaviour is quite widespread, so surely there's got to be a way where men, as you know, as Miki said, can apologise and make reparations and somehow restore their reputations.
I mean, far be it from me to be so bold as to suggest what the goals of the Me Too movement are, but here we go. My understanding is that one of the goals of the Me Too movement is not to just cancel men. You know, if you have harassed a woman,
that would be quite complicated.
Yeah,
it'd be inconvenient.
You're in the bin. You're cancelled. You're over. One of the symptoms or one of the byproducts of the Me Too movement is that, you know, men are being called to account, and powerful men in some cases are having to sort of resign from their roles or, you know, move out of the public eye in some instances. But this isn't the goal of women coming forward and telling their stories. The goal, in my understanding, is to stop this behaviour from happening. We don't want to be touched inappropriately. We don't want to be groped. We don't want to be harassed. We don't want to have our jobs held ransom to, certain behaviour, like, you know, performing certain behaviours or anything like that. So this conversation about, like, you know, if a powerful man has been accused of sexual violence, can he keep his job? It's, to me, that's kind of not even what the Me Too movement is about. This is a byproduct of the larger goal.
Just on the issue there of institutions, I want to talk about parliamentary privilege. And in the New South Wales examples, we've seen two very different sort of uses of parliamentary privilege around this area. First of all, we saw David Elliott, which we've just spoken about, where he used it perhaps for a very pointedly political purpose. And then we've seen on Tuesday this week that Jenny Leong, who is a Greens MP here in New South Wales, used parliamentary privilege to call for one of her colleagues, quite sensationally, to resign over 7-year-old allegations against him, which she said amounted to sexual violence, allegations that were investigated by a sort of independent process, or so we're told, by the Greens Party, and found to be unsubstantiated. So, I mean, has she offered him due process? Is it right for her to use parliamentary privilege in that way?
I'm interested to know whether the victim was aware that that would be brought up in that context. Do you know?
Jenny Leong, the MP who brought it up, said that she was aware of it, and certainly her name had been reported previously, unlike Ashley Raper's.
On the one hand, I think it's troubling if people are going to use parliamentary privilege to raise unsubstantiated allegations against individuals. But the other reality here is that the power dynamics that keep people quiet here, this is one way that Jenny Leong has seen a way around that. Because if you are, and we've seen this, I think, and I've seen this sort of said on social media a lot this week, sexual harassment is not the problem of the Liberal Party or the Labor Party or the Greens. It's a men's behavioural problem, so it spans all party lines. If the reality is that if you're a member of a political party that feels to you that it minimises and is unwilling to deal with allegations and instances of harassment, What are you supposed to do?
Maybe you are supposed to accept the call of the umpire in this case, which is there was an independent investigation. The complaint was found to be unsubstantiated. I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to have some sort of refereeing process, don't you, for complaints of this order of seriousness?
I think you do. And again, maybe I'm being optimistic here. My feeling is that it would be unlikely that someone would come forward and use parliamentary privilege in that way and be so bold if there wasn't more to the story, or if they felt that the... I mean, for example, think about this. If you think about the Catherine Marriott case with Barnaby Joyce, yeah, the National Party's independent process, or the referee there, if you like, determined that there was...
They said that there was an inconclusive... They couldn't come to a conclusion.
They couldn't come to a conclusion. And I think it would be naive to say that in these instances, independent investigations are always completely comprehensive, adequate, sound.
Sally, do you think that was a proper use of parliamentary privilege by Jenny Neal?
I mean... The thing with parliamentary privilege here comes down to two things. One is Jenny Leong and David Elliott and, you know, countless other MPs use parliamentary privilege because you're exempt from defamation laws. And in Australia, that is what holds back so many women from speaking up or sort of like affirming other stories of sexual assault levelled against powerful men, because we can't say anything. Just look at Geoffrey Rush and Erin.
It has a very chilling effect, a defamation threat or a defamation suit. I can attest to that.
As can I. So, Jenny Leong, for instance, spoke under parliamentary privilege so she could say these things on the record and be exempt from defamation laws. So that, you know, that's an interesting thing in and of itself. But what I am most interested in when parliamentarians in particular pick up the stories of the Me Too movement, whether with consent or whether not with consent, I think both David Elliott and Jenny Leong, there's a political outcome that is being sought by telling these stories. And I just think it is fascinating and expected that the people in power and institutions of power are behaving exactly the way that institutions of power and people in power behave, and that is they will take whatever they want. They will take what they want to make themselves more powerful. And so I'm talking about Me Too stories being used as a political tool, women being used as pawns. I campaigned for marriage equality for a very long time. I saw it in the marriage equality campaign. You know, we campaigned for so long and we weren't listened to, and activists like me were laughed at and sort of scorned and called naive or troublemakers. And then, you know, for 8 years, the Labor Party ignored us, and for 14 years, the Liberal Party ignored us. And then right at the end, they want to bang their logo on it. They want to be the party that delivered marriage equality. You know,
but isn't
you take
that
things.
The point? Isn't that the point that we have these grassroots movements like the movement for marriage equality or like the Me Too movement, and they reach a tipping point where politicians, it is politically expedient for them to take notice and to embrace those values. And are we seeing that tipping point now with Me Too and sexual harassment allegations? Because, for example, Luke Foley did fall on his sword. His party got behind the complainant in this case and said, no, you have to step aside and it's a really bad idea for you to sue for the defamation. Are we seeing sort of a slightly better treatment of these stories in the political sphere?
I think you're right in that the goal of many of these campaigns or these movements is to impress on people in political power and get them to pick it up and run with these causes. But I think what we've seen in New South Wales Parliament recently, and we've also seen it in federal parliament with sort of like taunts across the chamber about Barnaby Joyce or various others, is that politicians will pick up grassroots causes. They will pick up movements, but only when it's for their own political gain.
There is another big story that's dropped this week, which is former ABC Managing Director Michelle Guthrie, who's claimed a reason for her sacking was because she had accused the chairman, former chairman Justin Milne, of inappropriately touching her.
No, it was inappropriate. It was unprofessional and inappropriate.
It's a claim which he denies.
I never, ever behaved in any inappropriate way with Michelle. I had no reason to whatsoever, and I didn't.
Georgie, I'll go to you first. How do you think corporate or public boards should handle situations like this?
Well, I think this situation is particularly unique because the allegation was made at a point it hadn't been previously raised. There was, you know, her job was potentially at risk. I think that it's probably quite important to make a distinction between the language that she used was inappropriate touching. And I mean, obviously, as and the chair, Justin Milne, former chair, Justin Milne, said the same thing. He automatically assumed that meant sexual, you know, of a sexual nature. And I mean, I think because of the Me Too movement and the public conversation that we're having, that's immediately where your head goes. I think that there's other forms of touching. I mean, I would say as a general rule, it's pretty simple that ideally just keep your hands to yourself. I mean, that's an instruction that I give my, you know, 6-year-old and my 2-year-old quite regularly. The 8-year-old pretty much has that under control by now. I don't think that it's that difficult to just keep your hands to yourself. Having said that, I don't think every touch is necessarily going to be sexually inappropriate. But if the case is that someone is touching you in a way that's patronising, then that is an instance of sort of an abuse of power potentially, or it makes the relationship uncomfortable.
Is it possible that men in the workplace sometimes do that without even realising that they're being patronising or that they're disrespecting the
Definitely.
Person they're doing it to?
I think that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. Miki, you sound like you've got opinions on that.
Oh, yeah. Look, I just this discussion kind of annoys me. Not this individual one, but just generally this discussion on how people should negotiate their way in the workplace from now on. I mean, we're grown adults. We use common sense, and we just don't go touching people unless there's some need for it. If you're a doctor, you might touch your patient. Without wanting to be prescriptive about it, I just think this is a way of kind of sidetracking the bigger discussion, which is about sexual or inappropriate touching, to one which is about one where people complain that they don't know the rules anymore. The rules are always there. Maybe people just ignore them, but they remain the same.
Mm. Sally, do you think it's ever okay to touch or hug someone in the office?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, if you've asked their permission and they don't mind. Yeah, of course. I mean, I've hugged colleagues before. I think touch is such an interesting concept because it's two-sided in that there is intent and there is impact. So while a back rub, if we stick with this theme but not specific incident, like a back rub might not have the intention of being inappropriate or being sexual or being patronising, but the person who is being touched may experience all those things at once. And, you know, for women, you don't know how many times they have been inappropriately touched that day. You don't know... you know, where are they? Are they in a locked room? Is it just is the man drunk? You know, there's so many other things at play that feed into the context of power, that, you know, a touch can be so much more than a touch, or it can just mean nothing.
What about our reporting structures? Will it ever get easier to report this kind of thing within organisations or within political parties?
Look, sexual harassment in workplaces is something where there is every regulation and every law that's possible. You know, and those are not new. That's not a new framework. We've had it. The issue is we don't have a culture where those reports are taken seriously, and a culture where, where they're believed and where they are treated with the sort of severity they deserve. And so I think that, to me, it's not the reporting so much that needs to change. It's how those complaints are dealt with and how that's processed beyond that. And that is more than anything a cultural question.
And just finally, I might just go around to all three women and just ask whether or not where you see this movement, the Me Too movement, such as it is in the Australian context, going, and whether or not things are changing for the better and, you know, we're seeing an improvement.
I would say we are getting closer to having an honest, accurate appreciation of how widespread this problem is. I think for a long time, it really has been considered a relic from, you know, the 1970s that workplaces no longer deal with. I think that's changing. I am concerned, and I mean, obviously, particularly right now when you think about the Jeffrey Rush defamation trial, when you know, last Thursday when the story broke about Ashley Raper and you consider all of that, it's really difficult to think, wow, women look fantastically empowered for coming forward and telling their stories and holding men to account. Yeah, I mean, look, it is true that Luke Foley did fall on his sword. But I don't feel incredibly optimistic that we're in a position where the rights of women to just be respected and as human beings in the workplace is existing. I just don't think that's there. And I think that defamation is one big issue here in Australia that prevents that from happening. I'm heartened by the increased level of conversation, and I think the fact that there have been pockets of accountability is positive, but I don't see us being at a revolutionary point yet in how women are actually treated in workplaces.
Sally, isn't it true that politicians at least have to take this stuff more seriously than they have in the past?
Absolutely. And it's rife across every political party, and I do think that we will soon, I think we are seeing a moment of reckoning. What is not clear to me is whether there will be any consequences for that reckoning.
Mickey, what do you think? Are we heading in the right direction?
I think we're definitely starting to see changes. I mean, if you think about how this would have played out 10 years ago, I suspect it would have been quite different. But having said that, you know, there are so many structural and systemic reasons that women don't pursue their alleged rapists or sexual assault perpetrators. And I hear from women every day who have an experience that they wish to forget and who would never consider taking this matter to the courts or to the police or to another forum because they just cannot bear the consequences on them as individuals. So I think we're a very, very long way away from, women feeling safe to make these disclosures with no effect. But, yeah, we're definitely making progress. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And if we can't expect a year or 2 years to pass and suddenly the Me Too movement has changed everything, that's just not feasible or realistic.
Well, certainly there's a lot of cases that are going to be interesting to just see how they play out. Sally, Mickey and Georgina, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a really lively and interesting debate. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jackie.
Tony Wright here, Associate Editor and Special Writer. I've worked in journalism for 48 years. I believe the best political coverage in Australia comes from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The craft is being able to cut through the spin because decisions made in the halls of power affect us all. Subscribe today. Support news you can trust.
Police received reports of a vehicle on fire in Bourke Street. Nearby police quickly responded to the incident. As they got out of the car, they were confronted by a male brandishing a knife. Three people have been stabbed. Unfortunately, one is deceased at the scene. Police shot the male in the chest.
The devastating attack on Bourke Street in Melbourne has left the country reeling.
This is an evil and terrifying thing that has happened in our city and state today. And we condemn it. But we also take this opportunity to thank those very brave and dedicated members of Victoria Police who did all of us proud.
John Sylvester is a senior crime reporter from The Age. He is the author of the best-selling series Underbelly, which you may have heard of, among others, and he's spent decades reporting on a range of subjects, including terror attacks. John, first of all, how much do we know about Friday's Bourke Street attacker?
What we know is that he was a person of interest along with hundreds of others. There was nothing to indicate that he was going to do what he did. Police at the present stage are trying to gain access to his computer and phones to see where he'd been, whether he'd been radicalised, whether it was an idea that just popped out of his head. Now, we put this in context. At the time of that attack, we were having a trial here in Melbourne over the Bourke Street Mall massacre where six people were killed by an idiot who drove up the mall and injured a further 27. So there is a fair theory that it was copycat, that he wanted to go into Bourke Street and possibly even go into the mall, but that the bollards stopped him. Again, I say it takes some time to be able to get to this. The idea of keeping these people under surveillance is simply idiotic. The resources required to put somebody under physical surveillance is massive. Also, even telephone intercepts. And plus the fact people are entitled to go about their daily business without having a truckload of police in their backyard.
Nonetheless, as you say, he was a person of interest. Can you just break it down for us? What does that mean exactly? What does it mean to be on a terror watch list and how do you get there?
Well, specifically in this case, I'm not going to go into it because of other court matters, but he associated with other people who were suspected of being involved in terrorism. But I think we get hung up on the term terrorism. Is this a terrorist event? Is it not? The fella who was involved in the Bourke Street Mall matter created massive terror, although he didn't do it in the name of Islam. He did it because, well, he's never actually explained why. It created just as great carnage as if he was doing it for in the name of one god or another. The issue that the police are concerned about is how quickly people can be radicalised, and it can take days or in some cases hours. It's like a light globe goes off. But to drill down in virtually all these occasions, the offender has had mental health issues. And what the Terror Police are trying to do is work heavily with the other services who may have dealt with these people so that they can get files and they can work out what's going on. Because you have to be, by definition, disturbed to launch what is effectively a suicide attack.
That sort of crosses over with what some might call the politicisation of the attack. We had Scott Morrison this week doing a press conference, very strongly linking this incident to Islamic terrorism and putting the onus on Islamic communities to police, if you will, or to monitor people within their own ranks who might show signs of radicalisation or might look mentally ill or have any sort of signs of doing this kind of thing. I don't know what those signs might be. What's your opinion on Morrison sort of making that clear link so quickly and his statements about the Islamic community?
Well, I think in fairness, the police quite quickly on the night suggested that this was a classic terror attack. I think the Prime Minister is entitled to ask everyone in the community to come forward with information. But the truth of the matter is the motivation in this case is simply not known as yet. The advantage we've got with social media and citizen journalism is that we didn't get much of this secondhand. We didn't get a police report on how this happened. You could actually see it with your own eyes. The poor man from Pellegrini's who was killed, Sisto, is going to get a state funeral. That's something I'm uncomfortable with.
Why is that?
Because I think you're actually giving comfort to the enemy. I think what the end game for these people is they want to disrupt. They want to change our life and they want to make us feel frightened. And a state funeral, I'm sad to say, which will stop Melbourne, would indicate to people who, for whatever motive, want to do us harm, that they can impact on our lives.
That they've disrupted the establishment somehow.
When the reality is, if you went down Bourke Street now past Pellegrini's, there'd be a lovely, heartfelt floral tribute, but people would be walking past, getting on with their lives, as they do in the Bourke Street Mall, as they do as they walk past Lint Cafe. And that's why these terror attacks are doomed to fail, because if the end game is to change us, it does not.
And John, just quickly, in terms of monitoring people who might be on a terror watch list, is it actually possible to prevent these kinds of lone wolf attacks that might have been inspired by a mixture of mental illness and Islamic terror, possibly radicalisation from the internet? Or do we just have to accept that they're an inevitability of modern life?
Police have said for several years it is not a matter of if, it is a matter of when. It is truly phenomenal the number of plots that they have managed to foil. And the truth is, sad as it may seem, police are more comfortable with a semi-sophisticated group who spend months in the planning. The longer the take, the more people they talk to, the more they reach out, the more chance police have to disrupt. It is the lone offender who might have an idea. And of course, the weapon of choice is so unskilled, a motor car, something that we all have access to. And we are going through a process of putting bollards around the city, but under no circumstances are we going to close the city. You must have free movement, and so there will always be a risk. They're just trying to manage that risk.
John Sylvester, thank you very much for your time. It's been very interesting to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guests, John Sylvester, Georgina Dent, Sally Rugg, and Mickey Perkins. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Support the work we do. Our subscribers get unlimited access to award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to subscribe today. This episode was produced by Nicole Purcell. Technical assistance from David McMillan and Cormac Lally, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Jacqueline Maley. Thank you for listening.